Blog Talk Radio.
It is Friday night, and that familiar beacon means it's time for the political consciousness of West Coast Steelers fans. Well, we had a very good show last week. We talked to three women, all of different age groups, two out here in the state of California, one a homeowner, one a young, an older homeowner about to retire, talked about Social Security. Tonight, we're going to talk about the midterms, and we're going to talk about some of the effects. We're going to talk about the firing of Jeff Sessions, and we hope that we have a few callers. We're also going to have a very good friend of mine, Mr. Vic Singh. He's going to be on the show, Well, let's get the show started. I see we have a caller in the line already. Maybe you don't see. I'm going to call him back and see exactly who this was. It might have been Mr. Littleton. Let me see. Well, I guess I wasn't. I'm going to get Mr. Singh on the line. You have to excuse me. Seem to have a little cold tonight, but can't find anything to see sometimes. Like I said, doesn't matter if you have a smartphone, if you're a dumb person. Okay, we're going to get Mr. Singh on the phone. And for those of you that don't know, Vic Singh graduated. I'm not sure if he's taken his bar yet. I know he graduated. I believe it was in 2016 now. It's been so long. Good evening, Vic. How are you doing tonight?
Hey, James. How's everyone doing? Long time no talking to you, man. Good to hear your voice.
Oh, man, I could definitely say the same, man. It's, I guess what makes it really unusual is that we're not talking sports. That's usually what we do, but due to this current state of affairs, I have started a show that I probably didn't have when we first were, no, were acquainted and on the show there. So,
I'm glad that you have some, a way to talk about this stuff. I know you've been passionate about it for a while, so it's good that, you know, people care about it and that people want to hear about it.
Well, I especially, you know, wanted to talk to you because, you know, there's so many things that, that really pertain to you on a personal nature, educationally, immigration-wise, a lot of these topics. But let's start with something. Let's start with the elections. The Democrats grabbed 7 governorships and 33 seats in the House, but they still lose the Senate. So, Vic, can you tell me how this result actually further illustrates how 45 has divided the nation?
Well, really, it's been an uphill battle and trying to get everyone united and everyone on the same page. And as time goes forward, we see more polarized politics and more people holding true to, quote unquote, their party. So 45 definitely is a catalyst in accelerating that, but it's been on the rise for decades now. And, you know, we're a country where it's very competitive and there's a team mentality, a gang mentality sometimes, my gang versus your gang, my team versus your team. And, you know, we forget that everyone's supposed to be on the same team, and that's the red, white, and blue. But everyone forgets about the white, which is supposed to be uniting us, and everyone's so focused on the red and the blue. But as of right now, you know, based on the result of the election, there's a few good notes and a few bad notes. The bad notes for Democrats is that, you know, Florida looks like it's Trump territory. I mean, it's conservative territory. It's red, and it used to always be a swing state, and it will, you know, always be 49.5 to 50.5, but it looks like it's going to stay red even in the next election. Tennessee, that's another one, very red. But at the same time, we see some new blue. I mean, Pennsylvania, over in the Midwest, we see people winning seats and representatives and in the gubernatorial election. And it's encouraging in some places in the Midwest, but it's also scary that places like North Carolina, too, even, and Florida are just so beholden to 45.
Florida and Georgia, but Florida, North Carolina, but what about Texas and Georgia? I mean, we actually thought that we were going to make inroads in those two states particularly.
Well, you know, Texas, let's be honest, Texas, we never even considered Democrat even having a chance in Texas because it's been so long. And even though they're putting up the worst candidate possible in Ted Cruz, the fact that a guy like Beto couldn't beat Ted Cruz should be shocking and should be alarming to Democrats, because here you are putting up a very good candidate, charismatic guy who obviously knew how to run a campaign and get a lot of money and generate a buzz, because you even got Democrats winning House of Rep seats in Texas, which you don't see very often, but it was because of the effect and the fervor that Beto started. But if a guy like that can't even win and beat a guy like Ted Cruz, I mean, that's pretty scary. And I don't know if it's – I saw some of the demographics and the way people voted, but mostly we need a higher turnout between young people, and we need more – white people voting for Democratic candidates. And all, to be completely honest with you, it's just not happening right now. And as far as Georgia goes, I mean, come on, let's be honest. We thought a Democrat was going to win Georgia, no freaking way. But I'll tell you what, that candidate did a very good job. And it's tough being a woman running in an election, but being a black woman running an election is even more difficult. And she did an amazing job. And there were a lot of people who had her back, and it's not even over yet. And even with Andrew Gillum, it's not over yet, because there are votes still to be counted. And that's a scary thing to even consider, that here we are calling the race and there's people who haven't had their voice heard yet.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. As I've said many times, I don't know if some of the people that fought in the civil rights movement would actually think that we have made any progress, especially women, which even back in the time of civil rights was still considered separate from the movement. But it does surprise me that in this election, we did have a lot of turnout from people that seemed to be either disinterested in the election of 2016 or failed to turn out, or in some cases weren't even registered. So there is a definite, I guess, movement that way to get them involved, and we'll talk about some of those numbers a little later on. But when you talk about the Democrats taking over the House, now, I watched Trey Gowdy, and I was sickened at the way that he handled a lot of the hearings. Because even though, I mean, maybe it was because he was a prosecutor, you know, before he became involved in Congress, but just to watch the antagonistic way that he was questioning people, I mean, it would automatically put me on the defensive. How does this taking of the House by 33 seats, how does this reform those committees and the investigations that they're able to undertake now?
Well, one of the biggest benefits to a change in the House is that there's a change in leadership. So the chairs of committees, the actual oversight, the leadership, the direction things go are going to change because there's going to be new leadership ahead now. So we'll see what happens as far as Speaker of the House goes. I know that, you know, there's a big toss-up with Nancy Pelosi because she doesn't have the best reputation, and she is so disliked by the other side, I mean, even within her party. And yet you have President of the United States supporting her in her bid to be Speaker of the House. So there's a lot of politics at play. There's a lot of chess at play there. There's still internal fighting between the Democrats because new young leaders want a fresh approach to their framing of their platform. And, you know, the old school guard of the Democratic Party, they're saying, hey, look how well we just did in the House elections. Why would we even change it up? And not to mention that Nancy Pelosi was pivotal in the Affordable Care Act process, and that seems to be one of the sticking points of the Obama legacy, is that people really like the fact that he got rid of the restrictions on people getting health care due to pre-existing conditions. So, you know, there's small wins here and there, but there needs to be a way to unify the entire party, which still hasn't happened yet. And, you know, it's been fractured since the Bernie-Hillary thing. And unfortunately, no one's been able to step up and unite everybody in the same way that Trump was able to unite all the conservatives. You know, for better or for worse, whatever you got to say about the guy, he definitely got the vented rally behind him. And even though we had record turnouts in elections all over the United States, the conservatives still did well considering, because they didn't lose both sides of the House. And, you know, given all the bad news, the negative media, all the resignations, indictments, everything happening, the fact that Republicans still did so well, I mean, that's got to be kind of scary.
Yeah, you kind of segued me right into the next question, because you talked about how much, you know, was gained, and you also talked a little bit about, you know, what was lost. But going back to the numbers again, suburban women, the black and brown vote, and the independent vote all came out in a substantial report for the Democrats. Can an anti-Trump campaign sustain the blue wave without a genuine platform? The only platform that I see the Democrats offering is, look at what Trump did, not what can we do better or what should we do. Am I correct?
I agree with you. And I think they have to do a better job crafting their message and their platform, because it can't strictly be anti-Trump platform. As much as, you know, there is a push back against the president of the United States, the moment you make your campaign or the idea or the platform about him, that's when you lose. You win the game against 45 by refusing to acknowledge it, to stoop down to that level and to feed into whatever it is he's saying. Because, I mean, we watched him dismantle the Republican Party candidate by candidate by candidate, and we saw it coming with Hillary too. And then when he went head-to-head with Hillary, he dismantled her. I mean, it's just what he does. So whoever ends up running against President Trump in 2020 is going to have to be the type of charismatic unifier that can rally people behind their message. And that message can't just be, oh, I'm the alternative to Trump, because that wasn't good enough in the last election. There's no way it's going to work in the next one.
With all the animosity towards Hillary, and now you see even more animosity toward immigrants, you see very pointed trade policies. Have we gotten to the point where we do not trust a woman as president, and that was why part of the reason why the Democratic Party lost? Do we have to run a male candidate against Trump in order for the Democrats to win? Your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't think it would be wise to limit the lens of who should be the candidate to run against Trump by strictly off the bat saying that it should be a man, it should be a woman, it should be someone black, it should be someone white, whatever it might be, because you, at the end of the day, you have to go with the best candidate. And we're used to talking sports. It's kind of like the draft. When you're drafting, you take the best player available, not what your need is. Because when you reach, that's when you end up getting a pick that doesn't end up working. That's a bust. That's what happened with Hillary. She was a bust. We need to take the best player available and find a candidate who is going to be someone who can rally and get people excited about their campaign. Whether that's male or female, it doesn't matter to me. But it has to be someone who has the it factor. And especially on the Democratic Party, unless you have a candidate who has a it factor, like Barack Obama did, like Bill Clinton did, then it's going to be very difficult to win. You have to have some kind of a celebrity air about you, kind of like Beto did. And, you know, it might be too early to have these kind of talks to say that this person should run for president, but at the end of the day, if you're trying to decide between someone like Elizabeth Warren or, you know, Cory Booker or one of these other mainstream names that are being thrown around, I would rather go with Beto, because it's fresh, it's new, it's not establishment, but at the same time, it's not so off the beaten path that you can't take it seriously. You kind of need somebody who's not entrenched in what everything D.C. is about, because people still feel that sentiment. They want somewhat of an outsider. But at the same time, you need to have someone who knows what they're doing, because obviously experience matters in the White House, and lack of experience is why you're seeing such little legislation being passed right now.
It does. Well, we have heard, you know, rumors of maybe Beto being the next presidential candidate. But there's a couple of things that I've noticed, especially in this election, this midterm election, probably more than any other that I've seen in quite some time. And that's the labeling. Everyone has to have a label. Now we have Democratic Socialists. They label Bernie. I guess, you know, Bernie is a socialist. Hillary is either a liberal or a communist. It almost sounds like, you know, I mean, Trump says he's a nationalist. It almost sounds like we're going back to McCarthyism. That was even before my time, but I read about it. And it kind of seems like the same premise. If you aren't with me, then you're something else that has to have a derogatory label. Do you find that alarming in politics now?
I mean, yeah, it's alarming, but it's really not a surprise because it's the way our society's bred. We're a super competitive, throw the other guy under the bus type of society, unfortunately. And that's just the way capitalism has to make us feel. And you are attracted to people who are similar to you, have similar values, who have similar interests, and usually who look similar to you. And that's why everyone is clinging so hard to certain groups, and no one's willing to have conversations and share ideas and accept the fact that, you know, the other side is right about some things. You know, Republicans are right about some things and Democrats are right about some things. And then there's things they're both wrong about. So that just needs to be the true way that people look at it, because it's actual. It's factual that no one side has every answer. And unfortunately, because everything is so polarized and Republicans are so staunchly Republican and Democrats are so staunchly Democrat, and there's name calling and, you know, a lot of finger pointing and blaming and branding and framing of issues in a way that makes it look like the other side's always at fault. And now that with the way social media and stuff goes, everyone just already buys into a mindset and they just perpetuate that mindset by finding information and memes and statistics that tailor their preconceptions. I mean, it's just feeding into itself, honestly. And unfortunately, we don't have anyone who can unite us all. We have someone who is the most talked about person on the planet Earth that wants to divide us and is doing a good job of that.
Yeah, he certainly is. It's almost, I don't want to say sacrilegious, because I don't want to make it about religion. But then again, let's talk about this gentleman that Trump wants, or right now is the, I guess, getting attorney general. He said that judges need to have a biblical view of the law. And he specifically pointed, when I said the New Testament, thank God he didn't say the Old. I guess we'd have people stoned on the White House lawn. But anyway, isn't that a conflict of interest under the Constitution? For him to say that, I mean, you know, the judicial branch should be ruled by the Bible?
Well, I understand what you're saying. I think there are conflicts of interest in regards to the gentleman, but it's not in that his priorities are in the Bible. It's more so his affiliations with other people that are involved in investigation in Russia
which he is connected to in other ways. So therefore, that you know, there might be a need for him to recuse himself. That's the conflict of interest that I'm thinking about. What you're talking about, yeah, he holds certain thoughts and beliefs and has stated that, you know, religion, especially his religion, is a major motivator for him. But let's be honest, that's not too different from what Jeff Sessions was anyway. I mean, Jeff Sessions is the same, extremely religious, uses his religion as his moral compass, and therefore uses that moral compass to try to dictate the rule of law in the land. That's just already what it's been. So it's not too much of a change-up. I'm interested to see how long it lasts with this new attorney general, acting attorney general, because it seems the vetting process maybe wasn't as strenuous as it needed to be, which seems to be the case with a lot of the candidate appointees lately. So we'll see what happens. I don't know what's going to happen with him, but I don't think he's going to last very long as attorney general. I'll say that.
But you see, you're so good at right into leading me into the very next topic because, you know, we all knew that Trump was going to fire Sessions after the midterms. I mean, that was kind of a given. It was talked about for a long time. But does Whitaker, the appointed AG, does he have to be confirmed before he can really be effective? I mean, just making him appoint him AG, does he really have any quote unquote power other than just the title until he has the proper hearing?
There definitely has to be some type of a vetting process for him. It's such an important position in the government and in our legal system that you can't just willy-nilly appoint somebody. So, yeah, there has to be a certain process he has to follow. And until that process is followed and there's been a thorough background check on him and a vetting process, then, yeah, there has to be, you know, there has to be its due process that takes place. So he's not out of the woods yet. He's not going to be making crazy decisions. But he is acting attorney general, so there are some things that he's going to have the power to do. However, as far as major rules of law go in the land, there's nothing he can do straight off the bat without being confirmed.
Now, one of the things that he has said before that he doesn't have to directly fire Mueller, but you know, there was talk of how you drain the financial budget of Mueller, which makes him relatively ineffective. Now, is this something that he can do before he's actually vetted?
No, he can't. And honestly, you know, even if someone were to drain the fund or whatever you want to call it for the investigation, I'm sure Investigator Mueller could just put up a GoFundMe and get all the money he needs up to every cent to finish the investigation. And honestly, it's so far along anyway that I honestly don't know how much more time it's going to take, what the results are, but it's already taken so long. There's so much been done already as far as work, investigation, documentation. So I don't know. We'll see where it ends up going. But any chance in hindering it or slowing it down or defunding it, it just makes Trump look bad. So I don't think he's bold enough to make a move like that because it's just so blatant. We'll see maybe behind the scenes something happens, which we see some things happening behind the scenes in ways where people try to discredit the investigation, discredit the investigator. But as of right now, they just got to have to let due process play out.
I'm trying to think let's talk about the candidates that he is talking about making attorney general permanently. One is my favorite, Humpty Dumpty, Governor Christie, ex-Governor Christie of New Jersey. And then we have Miss Bondi down in Florida, who was under investigation for taking campaign funds from Trump. There's a third gentleman, too. I forget who he is right now. But anyway, what do you think about the proposed candidates? And do you, I mean, all of these people seem to have a lot of baggage. I mean, you know, Bundy, as I said, was from the Trump scandal, Christie, you know, from the closing of the bridge to, you know, the lavish estate down on the beach. What's your thoughts on these proposed candidates?
I mean, to be completely honest, I don't know how qualified they are. I don't know what their moral compass is. You know, all things. I don't agree with Jeff Sessions, to be honest, on much of anything. But the fact that he didn't interfere with the investigation is so crucial. The fact that he recused himself from that is something you have to give him credit for. And if there is a conflict of interest, and something as simple for Jeff Sessions was that he can't help campaign for Trump, that was enough of a conflict of interest for him to recuse himself. If there's some kind of conflict of interest, then there needs to be a recusal by the Attorney General. And Christie and Bondi, both of these people have extensive ties with President Trump. They were both affiliated with him during and prior to the campaign. And that very thing is being investigated. So honestly, it just doesn't make any sense for someone so close to Trump being the Attorney General. But that just seems to be the way he picks his cabinet anyway. It's just he picks people who are loyal to him. That's what he's done from the beginning. That's why Chris Christie, you know, had a different job before he was fired by the White House. So it's only a matter of time before some of those rejects start coming back because they're looking for bodies.
The Wall Street Journal reported that there's some direct ties between Trump and the payments to Stormy Daniels and the other Playmate of the Year, which would are financial, I guess, violations, finance law, campaign finance law violations. You also have two of Trump's closest, I don't know what you want to call them, advisors, his lawyer, Cohen. You have the ostrich coat wearing gentleman who's was convicted of many counts of fraud, and of course there were many counts left out. But even though he has Kavanaugh kind of sequestered away in the Supreme Court, saying that a sitting president can't be indicted, can they also supersede any state charges brought against 45, you know, such as these fraud charges and tax evasion charges in the state of New York, as well as other charges brought either in Virginia or the state of Washington? And why isn't anyone prosecuting the Trump family for their ties to the Trump Hotel in Washington, where the dignitaries all conduct their business?
Listen, one thing that's occurred because of the administration that's in place right now is there's been remarkable journalism and research done by people all throughout the world and trying to make sure that the person who's running the United States of America is playing by the rules and is doing everything they're supposed to be doing the right way, okay? There are a lot of things that are questionable about profits being made by the Trump family while Donald Trump is in office. There are a lot of questions about using the office of the United States president to benefit financially in some way, but that is all for the investigation and for the oversight that's in place by independent committees like the CIA, by like the FBI and all the other intelligence agencies to follow with their process as long as it might take, and to continue to watch and see what happens before they ultimately bring the hammer down and do what they need to do. Honestly, they're just one thing you need to learn about the law when you're practicing is that you can't do everything all at once and rush it. Sometimes better to let it play out, see where the chips continue to fall, and then choose the best time to strike and do what it is you need to do. So I think that's what's happening. There's a lot of watching going on, and the longer something like this takes, that means the more there is to dig up. So we'll just be patient and see what the end result is. But all these things that you're mentioning are very troublesome to think about. And we just need to make sure that whoever's in charge of the United States and of the executive branch, they play by the rules. They represent our country in a fair and just manner, and that they're a good role model for the people who come next in line. And we got to make sure that we have people in place to make sure that those rules are followed. So that's what hopefully this investigation will lead to. And if there's any misdoings, then the appropriate actions will be taken. And if, you know, the rules were played by, then we'll just keep plugging along and wait until 2020.
Here's the thing that I'm kind of worried about. Even though the Democrats have taken the House and they can bring forth charges or investigations, and they can change the face of investigations, by the Republicans solidifying the Senate, is there any way to indict a sitting president or this or Trump if he's found to be responsible for any of these charges?
To be honest with you, the only way it'll be able to happen for him to be impeached is if there's cooperation with the Republicans. And unless the evidence is so damning that they all turn their back on him, then no, it's not going to be enough for just the House of Representatives to impeach the president, because you need a collective unit of all of Congress. So unfortunately, you know, it's going to be very difficult with just circumstantial evidence to try to get everyone to turn their back on a guy who is filling their campaign coffers. But if the evidence is so bad and it's so obvious that misdeeds were done, I could see them turning their back. They always do, man.
Well, the reason why I'm asking this is because what happens if state indictments come down on a sitting president, such as the ones in New York and the ones in the District of Columbia? What do we do then?
Well, they let the legal process play out, and like I said, if the evidence is so strong that it looks like, okay, this person needs to be impeached, then the Republicans will follow through. But Democrats can't just single-handedly try to impeach the president just because, you know, there's criminal investigation against him. There has to be a collective unit of all of Congress, the House and the Senate, that votes him out, and it hasn't happened. the process hasn't fully gone through in America before. So, I mean, there's a lot of uncharted water. When it was about to happen in Nixon, he chose to resign. So that's the closest we've gotten, and we'll see where this leads. But you have to have the whole package. You have to have the Senate and the House to impeach somebody. And as long as Republicans control the Senate, it's not going to happen unless, like I said, the evidence is just so terrible against him.
Yeah, well, that's not a platform that I think that the Democrats could win in 2020 either, running on the impeachment of the president. But there's another thing that I wonder about, and that's when you're under indictment or you have as many cases against you as Trump does or did, isn't there a stipulation where if a convicted felon cannot vote, how can a convicted felon be brought into office? I mean, isn't there some part of the ethics of party politics or something? I mean, isn't there a code of ethics before you have a candidate, the face of your party? I mean, we point to the vetting of certain offices, but I mean, you couldn't have an attorney general that's been convicted of as many suits as Trump has. How does it slip through the cracks that only certain offices seem to have the responsibility of vetting, and others, it's kind of up to, I guess, the electorate, I guess. I mean, everyone knew of Trump's record before he ran. So I guess, you know, I guess my question is, what if Obama had ran, you know, having so many ex-wives, having, you know, so many scandals with women? Why is there a different standard today than there has been at any other time for the president of the United States in our lifetime?
And I understand what you're saying. If you were to pull up Trump on Public Index, it would be a lot of stuff on there, including divorces, foreclosures, bankruptcies, civil suits that he's lost. However, he's not a felon because he doesn't have a felony conviction on his record. So, yeah, there's investigations and there's stuff pending, but he's not a felon. There's no felonies on his record. I mean, he has a murky and troublesome past. Yeah, we know that, obviously. And he said things on tape and on camera that are disagreeable and, you know, maybe even self-incriminating. But
that's where the ethics come in. That's where the ethics come in. Not necessarily the convicted felon.
Yes. And, you know, these questions, sure, you can question the man's ethics, but like you said, he was elected because he won the primary for the Republican Party. So, like you said, does the electorate, are they the ones who have to be doing the research and upholding those ethics? And that's correct. It's a weird democracy. And so the people who vote have to be the ones who say, okay, this person doesn't have good ethics, they shouldn't be who represents me. But what the Republicans decided to do was say, okay, we'll ignore the troublesome things, we'll ignore the questionable ethics, and we'll throw our chips in with this guy because we think he gives us the best chance to win. It's like selling your soul to the devil. You know what you're going to get, but you sacrifice everything you are just to get that. And then I'm sure when you get it, it rings hollow and it doesn't even feel the way you want it to in the end.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I try to do is be able to face that guy I see in the mirror every morning. I think that might not be it. Seems like that's easier for a lot of other people, but, you know. Anyway, before Sessions left, he limited the ability of the feds to overhaul police departments accused of abuse. Can you tell us what that really means in layman's terms?
Well, that sounds like what it means is he's given more control to the states, to the municipalities, and to the local law enforcement agencies, which, you know, there's pros and cons to that. The pros are that you would think that, you know, a city police or a town police or a you know, county police would know their area, their geography, their people, their issues a little bit better than some other agency. And the cons are that there's less oversight and less regulation, which is the MO of, you know, all conservatives. And the result of that, which you and I very well know, is that that could mean potentially that people with our complexions are more at jeopardy because there's less regulation, oversight, and maybe even repercussion as a result of sometimes unnecessary police action. So, you know, you might see a rise in crime, or you might see a rise in crime busts and arrests. You might see the people who own the private prisons banking heavy off of this, and it's going to be a whole cycle. And, you know, a lot of people who are supporters of this administration keep trying to pass along the news that, oh, our president's in support of decriminalization of marijuana. But no one has ever said that and manifested it in this campaign. And, you know, they keep talking about it, and there are a lot of issues that they like to talk about, but they never came true. Like, I remember President Trump saying in one of his last debates that he wanted to impose term limits. And then, you know, once you get elected, all of a sudden, it's like, oh, I said what? No, I never said that. So there are a lot of promises that need to be fulfilled, but there are a lot of people who are willing to say, oh, you know, he said he's going to do it, he's going to do it. That guy's a man of his word, even though a lot of those things haven't happened. But they're just willing to give him the benefit of the doubt just because they buy so hard into what he's selling.
What about the promise to fix infrastructure?
Oh, there's so many promises. Come on, Jay. He was going to end Citizens United. He was going to do this. He was going to do that. I mean, there were a lot of promises made. It was like, it's like a high school election when you're running for student body president and you say you're going to put fruit punch in the water fountains. You know, it's things you can't really perform or achieve, but you sell it. And that's what good salespeople do. They sell it. And enough people bought it. And now, you know, the guy's getting credit for things he should get credit for, like getting, you know, two people on the Supreme Court. I mean, that's just, he got two guys on the Supreme Court. Obama couldn't get one. Obama had freaking 8 years to do it. He got two in less than 2 years. Okay, some of it's timing, but some of it's also, like, put your foot down and get the job done. Second thing he did, and he gets credit for, but I don't even know how directly related it is to who's in charge, but the economy. And the economy has been growing ever since Obama took office, and no one gave him the credit for it. And now it's continuing to grow, and Trump gets all the credit for it. So, you know, like you said, there's a double standard in the way things are judged and people are held in regard. But this president gets a lot of credit for the economy, for the Supreme Court. And, you know, I don't as far as legislative achievements go, you know, maybe the tax, whatever tax plan they pass, they might get credit for that, even though we, you and I both know that it's not doing us any favors. But aside from that, if you look at it, divisive rhetoric's at an all-time high, bad sentiments between police, law enforcement, and the citizens are at an all-time high. Bad relations between the United States of America and the rest of the world is at an all-time high. Our status at the United Nations and on the world scene has shrunk. A lot of the trade deals that we were in, now we're seeing the prices of things and the effects on the stock market and on stock markets around the world. We're seeing, you know, our partnerships with Canada and Mexico strain, our partnerships really all over the world strain, except for the one partnership that seems to be growing, and that's with Russia. So, you know, there's a lot of crazy things going on, and it's very interesting to observe and to watch on a daily basis. But at the end of the day, you know, I just feel like if we can find a candidate that can speak and unite people and preach a message, you could preach the exact same message Donald Trump was saying, word it differently and still win. And you could run as a Democrat and do it. It's just all in how you brand it, how you package it, how you market it. Trump's really good at doing that. The Democrats need to find someone who's good at doing that as well.
Sounds like it's kind of like selling used cars instead of running the country.
Well, yeah, that's how we got there.
Yeah, I guess you're right about that. In a fiery press conference post-election, Trump tells a reporter to respect the office, calling him a loser. He accuses a black female reporter of asking a racist question when she brought up his claiming to be a nationalist. And he also pulled the credentials of what he calls CNN, what he calls fake news reporter. Why aren't these repeated attacks on a particular media organization a violation of the press? I mean, when you single out a single news organization and you make them a target, just like he has embraced Fox News, I mean, isn't there a line that that's someone that's running the country shouldn't cross?
Listen, there are a lot of lines that were never even approached that now we're questioning where the lines really should be. So there's a lot of uncharted territory here. And one thing that should be unacceptable is the president of the United States trying to limit or discredit the free press of our country. One of the things that makes us who we are is the fact that we can share information, do research, support each other, and get the truth out there no matter what. It's what we are based on. It's what the revolution was fought upon. It's how guys like Thomas Paine could write a freaking pamphlet and pass it around and help spark a revolution. So it's something that's very important. And we all need to stay informed and to make the best decisions possible based on true facts. And unfortunately, the behavior of the president in regards to discrediting and even now pulling credentials for one of the biggest news stations in this country, it's just not a good look. It really just is not a good look. And to happen, for it to all happen, and him to look so unhinged, all straight after the election that didn't go in his favor, it's all too related. It seems all too off the cuff, and it makes him seem like a loose cannon, and that's just not how you want to come across when you need to be the leader of the free world and the most powerful country in the history of this planet.
Oh, man, I definitely, you know, have to agree with everything that you said, Vic. And that's, you know, one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on tonight. I'm also, we're also joined by a fellow friend of the show, Nas. Nas, how are you doing tonight?
I'm good, man. How you guys doing?
Doing fine. Nas, this is Vic Singh, a good friend of mine. We started doing a sports show together, but since then he's graduated from college. Vic, I believe you are now practicing law?
Yeah, I'm working at a firm in Myrtle Beach practicing with a lawyer as I study for the bar exam, and we do criminal defense.
Now, I know, like you said, you're working with the law, but criminal defense, does that also include immigration and possible dealings with ICE?
I'll tell you what, man. I live in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and we have a huge Hispanic population. And they, you know, they're a big part of our workforce, especially with all the new construction happening in our city. And one of the things we do run into is that, you know, we'll, for example, we might have a client who gets a DUI or some kind of charge that lands them in jail. And it used to be that once someone like that, who is an illegal immigrant, who's undocumented, is in jail, then ICE would have, you know, 48 hours to come and pick them up and deport them. And a few years ago, they wouldn't come as often. They might come maybe 10% of the time. Now, with this administration and all the funding they've put into ICE, they come 100% of the time. So now everyone who's an illegal is afraid to call the police, even if they're a victim of a domestic violence or an assault or, you know, for any reason whatsoever, because they're afraid that if they go behind bars or if someone finds out they're illegal, that the second they go behind bars, they're going to get deported.
I know we only have a short time. You only have a short time, but I have to ask you, have you seen a lot of separation of families? I mean, out here in
yeah.
California, it's well documented. But I think we don't realize that it's also happening in other parts of the country that are really not that close to the border.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, when I say what I just said, people might be like, oh, you know, that person broke the law, so they deserve to be deported because they're in jail. But listen, people go to jail and they're innocent because they just put them in jail and then they have the trial later. So there are a lot of innocent people that go to jail. And what happens is, like, they could send the father away, and the father is the breadwinner, and next thing you know, you have a mother and children left here in America who can't be cared for because the guy was working, but now he's deported, and now the government's having to take care of these other people. So there's a lot of links and a lot of relation and a lot of problems that America has, and they're all very interrelated, and unfortunately we can't find a solution to solve them all because it's a complex issue, and in a time where everything's so divided and people arguing so much, it's just hard to get anything done, but it's a true problem we face every day.
Hey, Vic, thank you so much for your time, man. Why don't you give us your final thoughts for the evening and tell anybody about any social media you might still be on.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me, James, man. You're like family to me, man. You did me so well early on in my career when I was just a guy watching sports and wanting to talk about them. So, you know, we've known each other for a while. I haven't talked to you in like over a year. You sound great. And I'm happy to hear you're doing healthy and doing well. And I just want to tell everyone out there that, you know, sometimes things don't go according to plan. And there are certain standards and expectations we hold for ourselves and things we need to go a certain way. But
God has his own plan, and we follow that, and we just do the best we can with everything we got, and at the end of the day, we should just be happy we're here and we're able to make a difference, man. So I appreciate you. Nas, it's nice to meet you, man. I hope to hear what you got to say. Even though I can't speak anymore, I'll be listening in, and I hope everyone has a good week, man. Thank you, guys.
All right. Same to you, man. Have a good weekend.
All right. Thank you so much, Vic. You have a great night, man.
All right, y'all. Thank you.
Yeah. As Vic said, we go back quite a long way, so I appreciate him coming on the show. But Nas, it's also been a long time since we were on the show. As you see, I kind of changed the format a little bit just because I thought this would be not just more interesting, but also it's about discussion. It's not about arguments, and that was the point of the show. So I'm going to start out by apologizing to you because you went through some of those episodes with me. And
no apology needed. No apology needed, man. I gave as much as I got, so it's all right.
Well, you know, hey, I don't mind that either. But you know, some people just, you know, there has to be a certain amount of control, you know, and you know, it was getting a little bit out of control there. But anyway.
Well, let me say this, though, James. I think we actually need the cable news and most people to actually make that same pivot that you chose to do, because I don't think these conversations are productive anymore when you have two people from opposing sides come in and yell at each other about what they think is correct, and you end up to where you can't really fact-check anything in real time, and you know, it just ends up being kind of a, you know, who tops who back and forth, but it doesn't get to the meat of the issues and we don't get to, you know, really lay out what's going on. So I think you're correct on that. And I think most of the media probably need to take your example on that. The whole crossfire setup is kind of, I think we've found the end of its use.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, at some point in time, you bring up a good point, because when things come to an end of their use, sometimes people think that that's a bad thing, but sometimes it's called progress. Why do you think people are so reluctant to label progress as conflict?
That's a hard one. I would say just because the media changed midstream and we weren't prepared for it, meaning the old gatekeeping way where we had three, you know, major channels for news and a few, you know, newspaper outlets, and people had a certain agreement on certain foundations. But once we had this situation where you had this explosion from alternative media, which a lot of times is good, but you also had a situation where people could just go to their echo chambers and decide what their truth was as opposed to the truth. So once you got that going on, you got two people talking about things, and one may appear to be talking from an alternative reality, you know, it's hard to really get anywhere with that. So I would say that would probably be the biggest issue there, the fracturing of the media that we weren't prepared for, so where now the majority of people get their information from their phones and tablets and, you know, their chosen bar, so to say. You know, they go to their particular bar of information and they drink up and decide the other guys, everything they're saying are, you know, is lies, and the only truth telling is the, you know, the people they listen to. So I think that's kind of, you know, where you really get the rupture there. And then once media became so much ingrained within ad buys and viewership and ratings, it became a situation where you couldn't, like, look, they had to cover those rallies, which ended up being, you know, free advertisement for the, you know, the now president. But they did a great disservice to the rest of the nation because they weren't fact-checking anything. They were letting, you know, everything just slide because there's no way to, you know, counter 10 lies in a row in real time. So everybody went to their sides, and now we have discussions on, you know, side issues that don't really matter. And because of that, we can't get to the meat of the real issues, which actually caused the problems. So, yeah, I think you made a great point with that.
Well, let's speak some truth here. 45 has claimed that his approval rate among Black Americans is at an all-time high. Now, you know, we had a guest who always his claim to fame was that he was part of the one. Now, if he was part of the 1%, and Trump's approval ratings have risen, I guess he's right, because Trump's approval among Black voters has risen a whopping 3%. It's actually down from 30% from when he was elected. No, actually, he was at 30% in August, I believe it was. Latino and Asian voters voted for Democrats in the midterms at 69 and 77% respectively. Nas, where is all this approval coming from when he seems to be losing, especially the Black and brown vote? We haven't even tabulated religion in here when you want to go, you know, possibly Muslim and other religions, but just going strictly by these numbers, do you think that this spells trouble for Trump in his reelection, or do you think this just reinforces his base?
Yeah, I think it's really more reinforcement of the base. I don't think they're actually growing too much outside of that. And when the polling is done is probably very important, because after significant events where you get a bump, if you do the polling then, it'll, you know, swing one way, or a negative event, then it'll swing the other way. But I don't think that really brings you into any crystal clear idea of what's going on. I think Nate Silver is probably doing a good job of kind of, you know, keeping a good grade on it. But for the most part, I don't think these things are actually that useful right now, because let's say they start talking about doing the infrastructure bill, but it goes nowhere. The beginning of the talks may see a bump because people assume it's coming down the pipe. Then when it doesn't go anywhere and he just walks away from it, then you'll see a decline. So I think we're probably over-polling at this point when it comes to this guy, because he has to try to make the case to why, oh, these people are coming over. But I think it's, in more realistic terms, they're just using these very low numbers as a way to try to destabilize the other party, to say, hey, these people are leaving that party, or that I'm, you know, gaining favor in that party. But I don't think there's any real meat and bones to it. And I think, you know, the other day was kind of a good indicator of that. There's a lot of people who are not only against this administration, but they see this period as us kind of in decline. And, you know, I don't think people are going to be fooled by, you know, some of the rhetoric on the trail of these rallies where, you know, he's yelling this stuff. So it is what it is, man. We're talking about really, really low expectations. You know what I mean? As far as his approval rating from those communities.
I was looking up the word nationalist the other day because, of course, 45 years that he called himself a nationalist. Now, are we unfair to think that he's referring to himself and his agenda as part of white nationalism just because of the color of his skin? Or is it because of some of the things that he has put in place by executive order under Attorney General Sessions? What do you think? Are we unfairly judging him?
Well, I don't think he's earned that benefit of the doubt, from his rhetoric to, like you said, his policies and his treatment of other groups. It appears that this man has a bit of a racist streak in him. So for people to say, well, maybe he didn't mean that in full, well, no, it's a wink and a nod to a huge part of it. Well, I'm not going to say a huge part, but a chunk of his supporters who he knows will take that rhetoric as, you know, as they want to see it. They will take that as meaning white nationalists. And then, okay, if we were to take him at his word, let's take him at his word and say he didn't mean it that way. Then what does he actually mean? Does he mean nationalists in this whole rhetoric of America first, which in a globalized economy, in a world that's much smaller because of tech, because of trade, and the globalization of the world, you know, that's 1850s nonsense. Like, that's not real world stuff. It works good for the aggrieved right now, because this is not just a U.S. moment, really, when you look at it. But when you look at Europe and you see the anger and I guess you could say anxiety from different groups over there who are looking for someone to blame, and Trumpism is not as simple as just being an American phenomenon. It's just globally the supply chains have kind of tightened a bit. We haven't figured out the new economy as far as jobs. Wages have been stagnant. So instead of trying to find solutions, the easiest thing to do is to find a, you know, an out group, point at them, and say, if we just got rid of those people, this problem would be solved. So I think that nationalist word that he used is a very strong word, and he used it for a reason. And, you know, like I said, if you were to give him the benefit of the doubt, why even use it, knowing that the implications would lead to what people assumed he meant? And, you know, today's November 9th. This is the day when Jewish people in Germany, their businesses, homes, and everything was attacked. They were pushed to the border, and they had to try to seek asylum elsewhere, November 9th. So it's kind of, you know, it's just kind of ironic to see this appeal to fascism, which shouldn't be taken lightly. And I don't think people should back off that charge. I think, yes, if you make a statement like that, which you know will be interpreted that way, I think he should be held to that.
Well, held to account is not one of the strong suits of this administration. But let's take it a little further, a little off the map, so to speak, of what I sent you, because still kind of talking about nationalists and what it means. North Korea has once again kind of shuffled Pompeo off to the side. They're now saying that, we or America has to make concessions, which they already had. They canceled the war games. The war games in South Korea had been held ever since, or maybe before Vietnam, I don't know. We also had war games with Formosa at that particular time. So we've already made concessions, but there's all of a sudden, things don't seem to be going as well for the Trump administration internationally. As you mentioned, the United Nations, our former German allies, all over the Asian world, Japan doesn't exactly know where it's standing. It's making deals with other countries. You could talk about the Iran treaty debacle. have we actually taken a step backwards? You spoke of 1850, nationalism. How do you survive in a 21st century world with 19th century policies and objectives?
Well, you survive, but you become less than what you were, because this is not a world where you can kind of bully somebody into a position as far as nations. These deals were built over a long period of time. Why? Because both sides wanted to make sure things were correct. And if I'm, you know, losing a little bit on one industry, then I'm going to gain, you know, a bit on another industry. Like, these things took decades to work out and figure out how they could be beneficial to most and to keep you in markets. So when you start to disrupt markets, then people start to make deals with each other and just cut you out of those markets. And since you don't have anything, or we don't have anything that the rest of the world can't get access to elsewhere, you can't even use your products as a way to try to bully people. So, no, this is kind of the road to decline. And the sad part about it is when you think in quarters and you're directly tied to certain industries and you want to make sure that those industries are artificially inflated, that may work for a little while, but eventually other countries start to push back. They'll start to sabotage other markets of yours to make sure you feel a little bit of the pain. And, you know, we've seen this for decades. So, you know, it's a crazy strategy. It's kind of hard to even call it a strategy, but you just can't put that genie back in the bottle. This is a globalized world. You can't dominate markets like this was the, you know, period of imperialism where you could decide and carve up territory and tell them what was what. Now those same countries will make deals either with your enemies or your allies, not only just to spite you, but to make sure you feel some of the pain. And we're seeing that with the soybean issue. We're seeing that with the steel and aluminum, because now most of the industry is scared to actually use their product because they don't know how the prices are going to fluctuate. So they're trying to hold on to as much as they can. And, you know, this is going to be a problem. And they're going to end up going to the government to try to get some compensation for it. And I'm sure he'll call that a win. But, I mean, just honestly, that's just not a good way to approach markets when there's other countries who could easily take your space within those markets. So it's a failing strategy long term.
Yeah, I was talking to Vic. He mentioned the immigrants you know, how many more cases, the increase in cases that he's witnessed there in North Carolina. Nas, before Sessions left, he actually, and I asked Vic this question, you may be a little bit closer because I believe I am, and it means a lot to my safety. Before Sessions left, he actually limited the ability of the feds to overall police departments accused of abuse. What does that mean to you as a black man in this country?
Well, honestly, abuse of police power is one thing that no matter what can destroy the credibility of any democracy. So the idea that you're going to, you know, put in these so-called protections on a group that really doesn't need protection. This is the one group who, no matter what, is going to have, you know, a good union, good collective bargaining, good representation. If they are in a situation that goes, you know, goes a bad way, they're going to get their fair say. They're going to be represented well. So the idea that they needed the scales tipped in their favor even more is absurd. Like, when you start to, you know, look at the history of these cases and see how rare it is for one of them to be convicted or, hell, even brought up on charges, for the most part, charges that stick, you know, you're trying to fix something that's not broken, similar to voter ID laws. And when you try to fix things that aren't broken, you actually create more problems than were already there. So, yeah, this is going to turn out badly. And honestly, I can't just lay this at their feet, because there was that Blue Lives Matter bill that Obama did sign before he left as well. So this there was a whole fervor to kind of reinforce these ideas of what the police can do, how they should be looked at, if, you know, they're acting in a way that's illegal sometimes, or, you know, whatever issue you want to, you know, lay at it. But if we saw this in another country, we'd say, oh man, that's horrible. You know, they got a problem there with authoritarianism, because that's what it appears to be. Police power and the ability to get a lawyer to represent you and to be innocent until proven guilty, these are some of the benchmarks of a democracy. And when you start to chip away at those things, it makes it really hard to keep those institutions alive and seen as credible.
You make a lot of good points there, but as a black man who's been through the system, I've always found that innocent until proven guilty thing kind of laughable.
Indeed.
I mean, you know,
innocent based on what type of representation you can afford. How about that?
Precisely. The better lawyer, the lesser the sentence, or no sentence at all. That's just the way it went. But anyway, I kind of digress. I'm talking about me here. But suburban women, black and brown voters, and independent voters came out in this mid-election to support the Democrats. But can an anti-Trump campaign sustain a blue wave without a genuine platform? Because the only thing I see the Democrats are offering is, we're not Trump, or look what Trump has done. Am I being pessimistic here?
No, that's a healthy critique, because you can have the energy to be mobilized by the acts of the other party or somebody who's unpopular, but in order for that movement to be organized and to sustain itself for a long time, then you've got to build the institutions that you've got to organize, and you've got to have people deciding on what platform it is that they want to fight for. Now, the issue becomes when you see like the DSA or some of the newer blood that's in the moving into the Democratic Party, they're talking about Medicare for all. They're talking about single payer. They're talking about bringing back unions. They're talking about rent control, because they're looking at the day-to-day of people and the things that actually exist as far as problems for them. So if those things aren't really addressed, then, yeah, this can be a mobilization moment that can quickly dissipate. You have to go back to the things that actually raise people's standard of living and allow them to, you know, to live good lives in the past. And, you know, these are the things that have to be addressed by the Democratic Party, or they could put themselves in a position to, you know, take even more losses going forward. And I think there's a lot of Democrats who feel that way and are pushing that way, but I think the corporate side of the Democratic Party are the ones who are going to push back the hardest on that, because they want things to be a different person sitting in that chair, speaking in respectful tones and respecting the office, but they don't want to upset the apple cart as far as most people's standard of living. Like right now, we're in the midst of an economic boom that goes straight to the top. Corporations are seeing record profits. We're seeing, Wall Street booming and things going well there. But when you look on the ground, the Main Street, you see people dealing with severely high cost of housing, rising cost of commodities, rising cost of utilities, water, gas, electric, you know, the things that people have to get through the day and day. And, you know, 80% of Americans don't have $1,000 to deal with an emergency. Like, when you're dealing with those type of things, then the Democratic Party definitely needs to go back to its roots, the working class roots of, you know, unions, full days work, full days pay, like, you know, all of the old stuff that actually made people's lives better. Those are the things that have to be addressed. You can't do this with emotion and the idea that you're mad at, you know, the other side because they're not governing well. That's not enough.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, pointing the finger. You know, it only worked for so long. After that, you know, people were like, you know, kind of like the guy that cried wolf. You know, it's like, okay, that's the way it is. But anyway, you spoke about respect. And it seems like now this has become a center for 45. I guess he would consider me very disrespectful because I never use president and his name in the same sentence. But anyway, if you recall the press conference,
you can't have it both ways. You can't have it both ways. You can't speak out of turn. You can't speak disrespectfully to people using nicknames against, you know, other your colleagues as far as other politicians, speaking to the press in a way as if they're illegitimate because you say so, getting angry when challenged on issues that every president would face in a press room. Like, if you think a media press room is something to be afraid of as a president, for the most part, it's because you're the guy who doesn't want to listen to briefings. You're the guy who doesn't want to listen to the people who hand you the information that you need to actually be able to discuss these things. And because he's essentially the child who's doing the book report but didn't read the book, when he's called on it, he lashes out in anger, and, you know, everybody can see it. Like, this is the press room for the president. Is like, this is nothing new. There's nothing unprecedented about a reporter trying to box you in because you're not asking questions, you're not answering questions sufficiently. Like, that's their job. They come there and they're trying to hold you to account. And if you know the material, you should be able to have a back and forth with them. But if you don't, and you appear to be really insecure about it, then, you know, they're going to turn into the farce we saw the other day.
You know, see, that's what was very interesting, because coming from a sports background, when coaches are interviewed, especially losing coaches, that is not a very pleasant environment. You know, so to me,
yeah,
you know, so to me, I mean, you know, a press conference, if you do good things, you have a good press conference. If you do bad things, then you have a very shitty press conference. That's just the way it is. Like, depends on your actions. But when he actually called, he actually accused the female black reporter of asking a racist question because she questioned him about his term of nationalist and nationalism. He ended up pulling the credentials of the CNN reporter because he said that he was a loser and he was disrespectful. So we look back to, okay, I'm going there, Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini, Mao, all these guys either burned books or more or less restricted what the press could do. Why isn't 45's repeated attacks on particular news organizations, CNN, MSNBC, why aren't these considered a violation of freedom of the press, even though he occupies the highest office in the land? I mean, this is still the Constitution. This man accused the writers of the Constitution are being unfair to him as a president. I mean, come on. Really? Really?
Yeah. Well, this is kind of a failing of his own party, though, because situations like this, your own party is supposed to wrap your knuckles with things like this. Like, wait a minute, what are you doing? You're hurting the brand of the party with your behavior right now. But because they've kind of given him carte blanche, they want to get as many giveaways and right-wing dream legislation as they can with him in office. And then once it's over, they want to kind of blame him for everything after all this is said and done. So they won't hold him to an account. And, you know, in this area where we have a president who has a firewall, essentially, full of supporters who have kind of turned the corner and become fans to where it doesn't matter if he's incorrect, it doesn't matter if he told a lie, they're going to support him anyway because they've taken the us versus them position. So for him, these type of things are good for his base, so it riles them up every time. They feel like he's yelling at those coastal elites who they hate. So for him, it's still good, no matter how bad the performance or how raggedy the answer. But, you know, overall, man, if you don't have a free press, then you don't have a free country, like, period. You have to have a free press to hold power into account. And alternative media is not enough. Mainstream media has to do a part of that job as well, because otherwise then you're just doing public relations. You're not actually holding power to account. So, yeah, man, you're right. That is a very dangerous thing. And it's usually led to you know, a lot of different atrocities. So we're going to have to see. And the thing I would criticize the press on the most is they didn't understand the dangerous moment that we were in. They were covering things from the position of this is newsworthy and crazy, so you'll click on it, but weren't giving you full context and saying the president just said this. This is not true. You know what I mean? You'd have to get in the body of the paragraph to find where he was challenged on something that he said that was clearly untrue or incorrect. And if you keep doing that, you not only propped him up to a degree, but you've made it to where his supporters can just kind of walk blindly behind him because they're not taking in any other information that would show, you know, where he's incorrect or when he told a lie. So, yeah, there's a lot of danger there. I agree.
I'm going to close. I said I was only going to keep you for 30 minutes, but I want to close with the Michelle Obama book. I believe it comes out tomorrow or it came out today. I'm not sure which. But I'm sure you've heard some of the excerpts from it and how she felt that 45 had put her family in jeopardy, and she said that she'd never forgive him for it. And then strangely, 45 comes back with, he'll never forgive her husband for the state that he left the military in. Nice, this man's a draft dodger. He used bone spurs not to go. And I do get emotional. I'm sorry. I do. You know, and it's part of, you know, I mean, I can't even think. Anyway. What did you think about?
There's never been.
I mean, shouldn't he have been the bigger man and you know, said, you know, maybe not, I'm sorry about the way I handled it, but give me your thoughts, because I can't even, you know, I'm like her. My stomach turns when I think about this and his response.
Well, this is the persona he created that his fans like so much, the never back down. So no matter what, even if you're wrong on an issue, even if your argument is ridiculous, you make that argument because you can't back down from anything. So even someone, you know, saying a position as clear as Michelle Obama, who faced something that, you know, that man, that's, we've never seen anything like that, where a political attack tried to just wipe out the leadership of one party. And we're just moving on like it's another wave. You know what I mean? Like, it's just moving on. So it's absurd that this dude would come back and try to punch at, you know, the other administration. And just to be, you know, just to be clear, there's never been a president who has inadequately funded the military. Like, that's never been an American problem. The military is always well-funded. So the idea that this guy who has given a raise to the military like Obama did 8 years ago, but he comes in and claims, yeah, this is the biggest military raise they've ever gotten. They've never gotten any. And people don't fact check it in real time and say, no, that's not true. They just got one 8 years ago. No, this is not the biggest one. There have been bigger ones. So because he can tell that lie, this man, as you said, who, you know, dodged the draft, can now use the military as a shield and kind of wave, you know, faux patriotism in front of people's faces. And sadly, I hate to say it, James, but that fan base ate it up because in their mind, he supports him. He supports the troops. Why? They don't have any evidence of that, but they've convinced themselves that he does. So to them, the draft dodging and everything else, not important. The important thing is he just said this. And they want to believe it so bad because they hated the previous administration so much, which is kind of how the groundswell started with them, with bringing back the birtherism charge and everything else. You can kind of see where that line of demarcation goes from one to the other. So, yeah, you're correct, man, for calling him out on it. But it is amazing to see what lies he can pull over the eyes of, you know, like I said, we're not talking about supporters. We're talking about fans in this instance.
See, I mean, you can't name a military base that he's visited. I mean, you know, maybe Walter Reed or someone like that, but he's never been to a forward base. He's never been to Afghanistan or Iraq or I don't even know if he visited the troops in Germany. I mean, come on.
But it's different. If you're the people managing him, it's difficult to put him in those situations because you don't know if he's going to fall on his face. They did the little sit down with veterans from the Vietnam War, and the veterans wanted to talk to him about, you know, some of the lawsuits and some of the things that happened to them while they were over there. And he starts talking and rambling on about the movie Apocalypse Now and what effect was on the troops in that movie. I want to say it's Agent Orange, but I probably don't have it correct. But the troops were trying to correct him. The veterans were trying to correct him. Like, no, that's not what we're here for. That's not what we're talking about. And no, that wasn't what was in that movie. And he started having a back and forth arguing with the guy about it. Yeah, he starts arguing with the veteran about it. So if you're the people who are managing this guy, it's kind of dangerous to take him to a base or something like that because you don't know how that back and forth might go and kind of completely shatter the facade of him being for the troops. So I think that's why he hasn't visited, forget what he might say or do.
Yeah, well, hey, man, like I said, you know, it's always glad talking to you, and especially under a controlled circumstance where we can really understand what they're saying and not have a whole bunch of people in the background or whatever. But you can listen, you can learn. And if you know, you can also reject, but at least people can be heard now, and we can all voice our opinion. So, Najah, why don't you give us your final thoughts for the evening, man, and I hope we can get you back on the show very soon, man.
No, yeah, man, definitely. Thanks again for letting me on. You're doing a good job with the platform, and I'm glad that you made the change because I think you're going to help a lot of people get access to information, which is very, very important now. So everybody else out there, I would just say organize, organize, organize. That is the answer to the issues we have. All of these problems we have can be solved, but they can't be solved without being faced. They can't keep being ignored and swept up under the rug and assume that things will be fine. We've got to get back to the old school hard work of solving problems. But thanks again, James. Appreciate it.
No problem, man. Like I said, hope to have you back soon. Just hit me up. Let me know when you have time available. And, hey, we appreciate you, man, and all the stats and the outlook that you bring to the show. So once again, thank you, and look forward to having you back soon.
All right, be back soon, man. Have a good weekend.
You too, man. My final thoughts for the evening, everyone. I'm glad to see that people got out to vote, but there's much more work to be done. Don't believe everything you hear. Check it out. This is a very modern age. You can put any question in your information bar and get access to information instantly. Use it to your advantage. Don't take other people's word for it about things that concern your welfare. Take care, and we look forward to talking to you again next week, right here on the Political Consciousness of West Coast Steel Affair. Have a great weekend, everyone. See you next week.